I like to do projects where I can look at the end of the week and say, I got that done. Or at the end of the day, I can't go to sleep at night without getting something done, whether it's going out in the shop and switching out. Let's say I need to rotate the tires on my ATV. If I do that, then I can go to sleep well at night. But if I don't do something like that, if I just go home and veg, I can't go to sleep at night.
Huh. Well, yeah. There, it feels good to be productive, no question. It feels good. We tackled some projects this weekend, helped my brother build a shade structure.
How did that go?
Yard. Good. Looks good. We're going to test it out tomorrow, 4th of July at his house. Hot dogs under the new shade that we just built.
Yeah.
So that'll be nice. But I don't care to do those things.
What, build shades or do hot dogs under the shade?
Sweat, work.
I love to do that. I don't know. To me, being a lawyer and sitting in an office is really like the antithesis. Nope. Of what I naturally want to be doing. I want to be working with my hands. I want to be building something. I want to see a finished product. And obviously in the law, you don't see a whole lot of that. Thomas and I, or even Adam and I, will sit down and we'll work on something, some language in a trust, and get it just right.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about, you know, wait till the client sees this. They're going to be blown away, right?
they're just going to carry you around the room when on their
the
shoulders.
Word gets out, yeah, about how the finishing touches that we put on that paragraph.
That, therefore, that is just going to hit.
Yes. Semicolon.
Semicolon. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to use a semicolon.
Yeah.
I like the full colon myself.
We caught a should and changed it for a shall, and it's just going to blow mine.
Me. Can't stand me.
Oh, no, yeah.
Like, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Me. That's never going to happen. Well, I have a list of to-dos that I was trying to get to as well. One of which is planning my dad's funeral.
Ooh.
And everybody asks, well, like, did he die? No, he's not dead yet.
Oh, okay.
And, I mean, I don't know if he's sick either. I mean, he claims he's not, but you never know. You know, he's at that age. He could kick over any time
so
now.
He's wanting to plan it.
Want to, because I'm going to be stuck with it anyway. So we had a client not too long ago where I was acting as a fiduciary for them. So they were in a nursing home, and she, you know, she didn't have mental capacity. She didn't know what was going on. And so she was on hospice. Hospice gave our office a call and said, hey, you know, it's not going to be much longer. She's probably got a couple of days at best. And so we got our friend Cesar Dominguez, do you know him, over at Desert Valley Mortuary. So we called him up. He said, yeah, I'll come over. And so we did the paperwork here in the office. Paperwork meaning you go, he's got, you know, here's casket options, here's cremation, traditional burial, embalming, that kind of stuff, refrigeration, all these things. And so you go through the price list, you pick the things that you want. And by doing that ahead of time, it's already set up. Number one. Number two, it's a lot cheaper. I would say probably a third of the price. And I didn't realize this until this conversation with Cesar. He was saying that when a person passes away, then it's an emergency if you haven't done it ahead of time. An emergency. Mm-hmm. So now everything is going to be a little bit more inflated, you know, when it comes to pricing and stuff, because now we got to get it done. You got this body over at the hospital that has to be released somewhere. And and so you only have a certain amount of time to deal with that body. Unless you have
how much they charge to hold a body?
I have it somewhere.
But is it a lot?
That, like, refrigeration.
Is it?
I have my binder right here. Look at this.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah. It's official. I still ended up paying like
$1,000 a day or something.
No. I ended up paying, I think, $2,500 in total to set everything up.
Okay.
That's for
pretty good deal.
Casket and things like that. But you know, if you're going to be cremated, it's going to be a lot less than that. He had a price breakdown somewhere. I want to say maybe, I don't know, $25 a day or something like that.
That's it?
Interesting.
Yeah, you don't want to keep them too long. And,
$25 a day. I could swing that for a while.
the biggest deal is, which I didn't realize till I went through this with Cesar, was that, so say you do this ahead of time, like we've done, like I chose Desert Valley Mortuary to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So we've already prepaid for all these services. Yep. When the time comes, if the hospital doesn't know that you've done that, then they will release the body to any mortuary in town. And maybe they have like maybe the person in charge that day has like their buddy or their go-to mortuary. And so the body goes to that mortuary and it might not be the one that you paid at. Mm. And so they can now cash in that. Usually use a life insurance policy to fund all this. So instead of me paying Desert Valley Mortuary directly, Cesar, so we put together the whole thing, all these services we want to do. Here's your price. And now he's going to put together a life insurance policy on a person. So it'll pay out when that person dies. But yet I'm the owner of it, but he's the payee. So Desert Valley Mortuary is the
covers payee. The cost.
Right. So when he passes away, that insurance company pays straight to Desert Valley Mortuary. But that allows for, you know, if that person were to die anywhere, maybe he's up in North Dakota or he's in Texas, because it's tied to a life insurance policy, the mortuary over there can now get those funds to pay for the services and things like that.
So basically the first mortuary to claim it gets it.
Yes, exactly. Which is kind of shady, which, you know, you don't, people just don't know these things.
Because I remember back, I don't know, this was a big Dateline thing 20 years ago where they were interviewing or going after these funeral directors, and they were having prepaid funeral services that were non-transferable and people would move, or they were taking the bodies and they were burying them in these mass graves, and they were not performing, you know, the services that they were paid to do. And so what that does with the insurance policy is it gets it away from being linked directly to a funeral home that may change ownership and the management may go downhill a little bit, or like you're different in a different location. So it gives you a lot more flexibility as to where to use that money. But at the same time, if you are dedicated to a funeral home that provides the services that you want to insure for your loved ones, then you may or may not get that one.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's pretty cutthroat. I told Cesar, like, this would be a sweet, reality TV show, because it sounds like it's pretty cutthroat in this industry.
I think
between morticians.
Well, and it's
no
interesting.
Pun intended.
Yeah, I think there is a mortician reality show, but I think it's like in, they're like Samoan or something, and so that it's the whole, you know, Polynesian culture and how they do everything. But I think there is a reality show of that.
How do they bury their dead?
Well, I think they bury them. But this more like follows the family. So it's like Duck Dynasty, but like morticians.
Oh, okay.
So it's like Death Dynasty. But it's something that, you know, I never thought about till I lost my wife.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, yeah, you're thinking about these things. We knew it was coming. So kind of like you, we were able to plan it, explore, figure things out. We had a good family friend who was a mortician who guided us
over at Johnson's. Is that
Edna's buried over at Johnson's? Yeah. And so, but yeah, caskets, grave sites. Just talking to you, just had Rachel on the show.
Yeah.
And so when she got home, we were talking about, you know, Brett, her husband, is buried in California. His family just had a grave marker. They live in Idaho, so they just had a grave marker installed there that matches the one that's in California. But you don't really think about those things at our age, and so it's left to sons and daughters to plan this stuff for moms and dads. And if you want to say in it, like your dad, then you should probably be planning it. So Rachel and I are talking about, well, where do you want to be buried? And, you know, all of those things. But I didn't, you know, I kind of got a crash course in it. But yeah, it's not cheap. And
sorry to interrupt you.
No.
And if this is too personal, just say, I don't want to talk about it, but, did you prepay everything just out of curiosity? So you knew it was coming.
We knew it was coming. And so we bought the grave site. We bought a family plot.
Yeah.
And then we were able to explore caskets and things prior. So it was like a package deal, so to speak. It included the grave markers, the headstone, but for like a family plot. So it's interesting. So I had to, I designed the headstone. I designed the headstone and there's Edna's name and information on it. And next to it is my information, except for the
expiration date.
The expiration date. Right. And so that's on the gravestone. And whenever I go there, I see that. And that's always a little jarring. You know, there's your name on the headstone, but you're not in there yet. And then on the ground is a placard, a grave marker, same thing. And so there'll just be a little plaque that gets screwed on, you know, when my expiration date comes. And then next to that is my parents.
Yeah.
Be buried there. So, and so we did it early enough that Edna was able to, she wanted to go see, you know, where she was going to be buried. So reluctantly I took her, we weren't there very long, but yeah, she wanted to see that. Yeah. She wanted to see that. And I'm kind of glad she did. Cause it kind of, you know, if you die and you don't know where you're going to be buried, you don't know where you're buried, we assume. And we assume that they live on. And so I'm sure you do know where you're buried. But, you know, she was able to go and there's a bench and sit under a tree and okay, this is where it'll be. But it kind of helps me tie her to that spot because she was actually there in life. So that's kind of cool. I kind of appreciate that she wanted to do that. I don't know, you know, if I would have wanted to do that. I certainly didn't think about it until I had to think about it. So it's good that you're thinking about it. There was a movie with Robert Duvall. It's a great movie. It's called Get Low. I don't know if you've seen it.
I've not seen it.
I've heard of it.
It's a good one. So this is a guy, it's set kind of in like the old West, and he tells everyone, hey, I'm having my funeral. And so he decides, everyone in the town hates him. He's got a horrible reputation. He's like the town pariah. Like nobody wants to talk to this guy. He's a cranky old mean man. But he decides, why should everybody else get to enjoy my funeral? And I don't get to enjoy it. So he basically has his funeral we talk about prepaying. He actually has a pre-funeral. Throws a big deal to get people to come because everyone hates him. He says, I'm gonna have a raffle. And whoever wins the raffle gets my land.
Oh, nice.
He's got 1,000 acres or 100, you know, he's got a cattle ranch or I can't remember exactly what he has, but that gets everyone to come out because they want to win his land. But in the process, he gets to people, you know, have to talk about him. Part of the deal is you have to say something about him and stuff. And so he's sitting there and all these people are saying things about him and, really good movie. Interesting. They learn through what's said, maybe he's not who they assumed he was and those kinds of things. So it still has a good message, but yeah, maybe there's something to that. Having the celebration of life while you're alive,
yeah, I agree.
might be kind of interesting.
I think COVID really changed my perspective on weddings and funerals because there were several there that I had to go. We didn't do the whole blowout thing for weddings. It was like in the backyard. You just get in there, get it done. And that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Just come in, get the thing done and leave. Like it was great. Same with the funerals. Like we would go to the graveside service. I love graveside services. It wasn't this all day marathon where you go sit at the funeral for 2 hours, you know, and then you got to drive over to the cemetery and you got to do that whole thing. So it's a whole day event.
It's a lot.
I mean, I say it derogatorily, but, you know,
but then at the same time,
but at the same time, come on. I got things to do on my Saturday.
Well, that's life. You still have life to live. But when you're shopping, you know, for all this funeral stuff, it's difficult to, you love this person so much. You want this to be worthy of them and their memory that almost it becomes I don't care what it costs. Right. You're just going to do it.
Yeah. And that's,
you know? And these guys know that, which is, it's a fine line. We were fortunate that we had, you know, a good family friend in the business that was able to guide us and kind of keep me
the pitfalls.
Yeah. Kind of, you know, let's do this. It'll save you some money and those, cause initially you're just like, you know, I'll sell my house, you know, take my car. This person's going to have, you know, the Taj Mahal, you know, and that's what you want. And so, the reality is that's very expensive. Grave plots, I found out, are extremely expensive.
Yeah. It's real estate.
It's real estate. And then, you know, and it's forever, you know, it's not like it's going to be something else, you know,
timeshare,
except for in Poltergeist, they built a neighborhood on it. So
true.
Maybe someday
that cemetery.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind coming back and haunting some people.
That what you're talking about, that I'm so glad. That's one of the biggest things that I feel at peace about is having this done ahead of time. Because when I told my wife what the plan was with my dad, she was like, oh, no, we're not going to just put him in that. And I'm like, no, we are. That's what he wants. I had the conversation with him.
Yeah.
He doesn't want this elaborate casket. He doesn't want any of that. He wants this. Yeah. And I was the same way. I'm like, what's the bare minimum? And I was like, well, okay, not that bare minimum. Once they tell you what the bare minimum is, it's like a cardboard box, you know?
Sure.
And it's not bad. Like I'm okay with that, but I probably want to step up. I said, what about like the things from like Tombstone?
Yes. You know,
like pine box or something. Yes. It's like, oh, we call those toe squishers or something, toe kickers, because they're big up here and then they go they taper down. And so you have to really squeeze the feet in. I'm like, well, that's kind of gross. I don't want to, you know, like you have a square box made of pine.
No, I'd like to. And we always say it kind of jokingly, like, oh, at my funeral, I want this or that. And that was actually helpful that Edna was able to have input in her own funeral. She was able to pick who spoke. Mm-hmm. She was able to pick what we ate afterwards. You know, it was her deal. And that was, I appreciated that, because had I not done it with her input, I probably would have done it differently. Not that she would have cared, likely, but it gives you just a little bit of extra comfort and peace knowing like we're doing what this person wanted us to do for them. So your dad doesn't want a big elaborate, you know, gold plated casket, you know? And so that is, you know, it's part of them. And then when you go visit that gravesite, it's, they had some say in that, you know.
I think maybe there's a more like of a, I don't know if peace, but a resolution that maybe might come from that, knowing when the whole, and maybe you know this better than anybody, once you go through the whole process, having had set it up and then knowing that Edna had a role in all that, there's a little bit more of a finality, rainbow maybe at the end of the whole journey.
A little bit of closure. And
in such a dark time, you still have the solace that this is how she wanted it. This is how this person wanted it. And we did it, right? The finality of all that.
Well, and it's an odd, it's not something that we do, right? You know, we just don't think about that.
You don't want to think about it.
You don't want to think about it. We don't want to think about it. You guys are in trust, so you're
thinking about it
all the time. You know, you're getting paid to think about it for people. But at the but most people, this is very foreign. This is very, you know, I can't believe I'm here, looking at caskets and those kinds of things. It's very jarring to go through that process. It's exhausting. There's a lot to it.
Yeah.
You know, transport. Just everything. And so anytime you can have the mortuary, anybody say, we're going to handle that. You're like,
yeah.
Where do I sign? We're going to take that over. Cause you're, you know, usually right out of a super, you know, low traumatizing thing. And then at the same time, you're having to make financial decisions and decorative decisions and invitation decisions and write things out. It's exhausting. It's an exhausting week or so. Yeah. Going through photos and putting together things and doing a program and all of that is not something that you want to do, but you have to do. And then you feel, when I was in it, I was like, okay, this has to be her. This has to represent her life. This is it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do this again. And every year it's not a birthday, you know, this is it. You know, this is the summation of this person's existence, you know, in a 1 hour, 2 hour service.
Right.
And that's heavy. You know, that's heavy to deal with.
I think there could be, as you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, well, it reminds me of kind of like, cramming for a test the night before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to use 1 hour of a service at your funeral to sum up who you were as a person, I think that's cramming it all in at the end.
It's hard.
Hopefully the hope would be that you leave your mark on the world some other way.
Right.
Maybe that's with your kids and the wonderful people they turn out to be, or the crappy people they turn out to be. You know, that's the thing, is like, that's my challenge that I've been thinking about for probably the last year and a half, 2 years. The reality of my finality is like, well, people come and go all the time. Like, mm-hmm. they're here, they're gone. And two generations down, what mark did you make, if any,
right,
on this life?
Legacy is what you're talking about.
Yeah. So how do you do that in such a way that two generations down or three, your name is still there and hopefully for good, right?
Yeah,
I don't know.
We've talked about this a little bit in your role as an architect and leaving your mark on the town and being able to drive through. And you've talked about it in life, showing your kids and your grandkids, mm-hmm. hey, you know, I built that school, or I designed that school, and that building over there, that's me. And you kind of have a signature on the buildings that you do. There's some new construction that you want to put in to kind of bring a new flavor to mm-hmm. Yuma. Is that what you want to leave as your legacy? Is that, I suppose, as just, obviously we all want to be good people, right?
Sure.
And yeah. we want people to remember us for being generous and kind and all those things. But you also want to leave perhaps a mark on the society and the town that you left. And so tell me a little bit about yeah. that, because you've thought a lot about that.
Yeah,
I know we've talked about
it. It's one of the rewarding aspects of my career is that you are. I mean, these buildings, you know, these buildings could stand for who knows how long, you know, for, you know, 50 years, 60 years, maybe longer.
Or even the concept of putting it together, like the Sunflower District is a new concept.
Yeah. So the Sunflower District is, so Rachel and I, you know, we've got four kids. And so when our kids were teenagers, it was difficult to find a job, you know, mm-hmm. and it shouldn't be difficult to find a job as a teenager. It wasn't difficult for me in the, you know, early 90s. It wasn't difficult, but it's difficult now to find jobs. So we're like, we should create a place where teenagers can work and do all that. And so that kind of started us thinking. And then Rachel talked a little bit about it last week on the show. We had a friend approach us, say, hey, I'm thinking about purchasing this franchise. And we thought, well, this would be a great thing, you know, for kid, you know, our kids won't benefit from it because they're older by the time this thing comes around, but it'll be a place for teenagers to work, you know, good kids to get experience and those kinds of things. We wanted to create that. And so we started, and so our friend came and said, hey, I'm thinking about buying this franchise of this company called Twisted Sugar. And we said, you know, let's try it out. So if you don't know what Twisted Sugar is, twistedsugar.com is imagine like Swig. So they're these franchise of soda shops, you know, where they'll have hundreds of different drink combinations, but then combine that with like a crumble. So cookies, gourmet cookies, delicious cookies. So we went, it's okay. Well, that sounds like something, there isn't anything like that in Yuma. Sounds like something that would be received well. It's, you know, it's quick, it's easy, drive through, low price. It's hot. People want to drink. They get their Starbucks in the morning. They get their soda for their afternoon kick and mm-hmm. kind of refresher.
Yeah.
So we thought it'd be well received. So then we went and tried them all. We went to Sodalicious. We went to Swig. We went to Twisted Sugar. We went to, they're all over the Fizz. There's several franchises of these things. And then we went and tried all the different cookie shops. You know, Crumble is kind of the leader. But their main competitor, and actually has grown faster than Crumble, is Twisted Sugar. So we tried one of those. Far better cookie. We're excited about it. it's going to be fun. So we also wanted to bring something to Yuma that was new, but had some new energy, something fun and exciting. We have plenty of nail salons. We have plenty of taco shops. We have plenty of legal offices. We have plenty of, you know, the thing,
pawn shop,
the usual stuff. Yeah, the usual stuff. We didn't want to bring the usual stuff. You know, another restaurant that kind of serves the same thing. You know, we have plenty of chicken, you know, tender shops in town. Those kind of things. We said we want something new. And so
that's risky though.
It's a little risky. I mean, but that makes it
could be received
exciting.
Really well.
Yeah.
And it's always puzzling to me which restaurants do well. Like for example, had several come in. There was Broken Yolk that came in and it died out pretty quick. And then we had Outback Steakhouse that was here, and it was here for a little while, maybe 10 years.
I miss Outback.
And then it died out.
Yep.
And I don't understand if it was mismanagement or if it was just a lack of enthusiasm around the type of food that they prepared. I don't know. With Outback, I tend to think that it couldn't have been the food because it was always busy.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I think that was a corporate decision. But
yeah. And then you got these places like, Mr. G's.
Yeah.
Right? And people are shipping that across the country because it's so popular. And how do you get something that just works its way into the fabric of the society where people have to have it and they're lining up for it? These Dairy Queens, there's always a line of cars for these Dairy Queens. And they're usually not in the nicest locations or facilities, but people are still lining up for them.
Yeah.
And so...
horrible service.
It takes forever. It's like how long to fill that cone, right? Or blend that blizzard. Anyway, how are you going to make yours so it's the Dairy Queen or the Mr. G's?
Yeah, so one is, I think what we struggle with in Yuma is it's not a, although there is wealth in this community, it's not a wealthy community. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the price point needs to be at a point where people can, from all different demographics, can enjoy it. You know, the sit-down restaurant, not everyone can enjoy that all the time. The quick, you know, fast food restaurant does better because people can get that all the time and can usually afford that. So the price point's got to be good, which sodas are inexpensive. You know, it's a few dollars. A cookie's a few dollars. So you can get in and out of there for under $6. Mm-hmm. And have a drink that you can nurse for an hour or more. You can have cookies so you can get a little treat. There are some healthy things there too. So you can't swing all sugar. You know, you gotta have some healthy choices as well.
Do you really?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess some people still prefer a banana to a cookie, but I don't know any of those people,
okay,
but, yeah. They're out there, I'm sure. So there's that, but then also kind of the sabor, the flavor of Yuma, is something that we think, this can work with. So, when you have seasonings like tahine and those types of things,
first time 2 weeks ago,
lime, coconut. So these are all things that I think we'll weave in pretty successfully. To our local, you know, flavor. Every town has kind of like a flavor profile. You know, you got your barbecue towns, you got your steak towns.
Yeah.
You know, Yuma is a taco town. That's what we are. So we need to embrace that, but you need dessert after your taco. So this can weave in with that. And it's quick, accessible. We'll have a drive-through. So it'll actually be right across the street from the Dairy Queen on Avenue B.
Mm-hmm.
Will be our first location. Construction should start in a couple months. You'll start seeing signs going up.
How many people will you employ?
So when you buy the franchise, you get with that, you get, they consult with you, they plan with you. So they know kind of what we'll need.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine we'll need, you know, a dozen or so employees. We'll need a head baker. You know, these cookies are made from scratch. These are not frozen balls that show up that we just throw in the oven that get shipped from Michigan or someplace. These are made from scratch, homemade every day cookies. I think there's 40 options. There's kind of 25 or so that are the mainstays that we always have. And then the signature cookie, which is delicious. It's a sugar cookie with coconut icing and lime, a fresh lime wedge. And when you squeeze that lime on that coconut, it's delicious. Which I'd never thought about lime going with that, but it's awesome. It tastes so good. So those ones will be there all the time. And then there'll be like monthly ones or seasonal ones that come and go. But you can buy one or you can buy dozens, you know, it's kind of scalable.
Okay.
So it works on just
a birthday party.
Yeah. It works on like a large scale. If you have got a whole event coming up, all the way down to, hey, I just want to swing through there and I don't want to get out of my car and go get a soda. Mm-hmm. You're going to swing through the drive-thru and get a soda. My favorite's the Raspberry Dream, which is a Dr. Pepper. I go with diet, of course, to help a little bit. Diet Dr. Pepper, raspberry puree, so real fruit, just kind of smashed, you know, in there. And then coconut cream. And yeah, it's delicious.
I'd love to try that.
Yeah, it's real good. Well, you'll get to. So that should open in the spring. So we're excited about that. And then our second location, we're currently working on negotiations for a location in the foothills.
I've been trying to get it
next year,
right next door to our office.
We're working on that. Well, that's one of our options that we're looking at. But, you know, building and planning and design takes a lot of time. So when you see a new restaurant, like right next to my office, they're putting up that Bubba's 33.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's going up. And, you know, I know what it takes, you know, years usually to get to the point that is at. So when you're exploring the location, is that the right town to open this restaurant in or this franchise?
What's Bubba's 33?
It's owned by the same group that owns Texas Roadhouse.
Oh, okay.
And so it's kind barbecue. Of, it's got kind of a Buffalo Wild Wings feel, kind of a sports bar feel, but it's like home cooking barbecue food, I think.
Okay.
I've never been to one, but it is it's a chain. It's big and the building's huge. But it takes years to get to that point, you know? So when you talk about, you know, hey, we're going to open this or open that, it doesn't just pop up, you know, within a month you're up and selling cookies.
Yeah.
You know, this is something that we've been working on. Our friends, which brought us the idea, have since moved away. You know, he got a job offer somewhere else. So we're on our own with this, which we weren't expecting. But we're excited about it. Rachel's going to be busy because she's going to kind of run it, you know, but I'll be, of course, there to support and help and eat cookies.
You've got that cooking, but you've also got the Sunflower District, which is something.
So the Sunflower District is a project that is also in the works. It's on the boards, as they say, but that is Yuma's first indoor food hall. So that will be built, just north of Harkins Theater.
So we got the mall, but we missed out on the food court portion of the mall where you go into this big open.
Yeah. We don't have a food court like you had growing up in the indoor mall.
So you're going to do just the food court portion of it by the mall.
It's by the mall. It's connect right off the parking lot of Harkins. We'll have spots for, I think the latest design has 18 vendors. So those will be lease spaces that we'll lease out to local vendors. We'll have a call to food artists soon.
The difference is that in the food court is they typically have chains, whereas what you're going to have is
we
homegrown individuals.
Yes, we want to support local restaurateurs. So the deal with, there's a lot of people in Yuma that have a lot of great ideas, and there's a lot of rich culinary people here that enjoy different culinary experiences, but it takes a lot of money. It's hard. Mm-hmm. Banks don't loan to a startup restaurant. That's why you see the success of food trucks. But even a food truck is several hundred thousand dollars to outfit a food truck.
Yeah.
To build a brick and mortar store, you know, millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So if somebody's got a great idea for for a food item, something that will enrich Yuma, that will lift the kind of the culinary one note that Yuma has existed in for such a long time. We want to foster that. So
we have something similar to it, an outdoor version.
There is an outdoor one, Eddie's in San Luis, which is great.
Well, then there's the one, you know, it was at the old mall off of 32nd Street.
And like on Fourth Friday Avenue. Nights.
Oh yeah, Friday Night Munchies or something.
Yes, and
like
then
that.
They did it.
It was a hit.
Yeah, it's loaded and packed, mm-hmm. and there's different vendors that come and go. And so what we want to do is kind of capture that vibe.
Yeah.
But give it clean it up a little bit, make it an experience, indoor. We'll have a bar, we'll have live music. We'll have outdoor gaming areas, those kinds of things to play games, to hang out. Mm.
A Dave and Buster's type games?
No. You're
what type of games are we talking
dragging
about?
Dragging us through the gutter here. Come on now.
I don't know. What other games are there?
No, lawn games, things that you would play with your friends while you're munching. You might be having
cornhole.
You know, having something. Maybe. I hear you're good at that, so we'll see. But so we'll have different vendors, we'll have the bar, we'll have it'll have indoor dining, but the idea is that you could go and order from, you might want some kind of wood fire pizza, your son might want some kind of ramen, your wife might want some kind of pasta, something like that. You can all walk into this one singular place, order what you want, but then sit down family style and enjoy it while maybe live music plays and those kinds of things.
That's what we do at the fair.
Similar, yeah. So you're kind of capturing that kind of, because here's the deal with going out to eat.
All, you know?
You know, eating out typically is a positive experience. It's typically something special, date night. Maybe it's a celebration of some sort. It's always, you know, typically eating out is wrapped around some kind of positive experience, some kind of positive vibe. And we want to build on that. We want to create a place that's exciting to go to, but also it's got to be good. The food's got to be good. So we're going to do a call to artists. We have a few local vendors that we have in mind. Mm-hmm. We want to court to go in there. There's a couple.
You don't want to say him over the
not
air?
Not yet. No, oh, okay. Not yet. So, but we want something different. We want something different offerings. We don't. One of my problems with the Friday Night Munchies is it was kind of a lot of the same things. So you've got this guy selling tacos, this guy selling birria, this guy's selling roasted corn, and then you walk over to the next lane and it's tacos and it's birria and it's corn, but maybe they're seasoned a little different. We're not looking for anything like that. We're looking for cultural foods, exciting foods, different foods, things that people may say, hey, I've never, you know, I love Chinese dumplings. Where do you get those in town? You know, there might be one or two places in town that have, but they're fantastic and delicious. And everyone who eats them is like, why don't I eat this? This is awesome. You know? So, there's gotta be people in town that want to bring this, but just don't have the funds. So this
far away is this project from being,
it's a couple of years. Yeah. It's a couple of years away.
Okay.
But like I said, it's years in the making. Getting the land, getting the zoning, getting the permit.
I was
going to
ask if it's already zoned. I mean, I'm sure getting it's the commercial.
Yeah,
maybe it's ag.
It's ag. It needs to be rezoned. It's the city's already done the plan amendment so that it's allowed to be rezoned. We just have to pull the trigger on it. And that'll happen when we submit plans.
You don't want to pull the trigger too quick because the taxes are going to just skyrocket.
Well, yeah, you don't want to do it until you're ready to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and which we're finding out at the Twisted Sugar location. So that was, you know, a certain tax rate. And then as soon as you put a shovel in the ground, it's like, guess what? You know, triple your taxes.
Which is interesting because Chase, your brother, has been on the show several times and he's been very adamant about that formula that the city applies to different improving land and zoning land. He said, why should I have to pay more because I'm contributing more to the city? Why should I have to pay more because I'm building a nicer house and the person next to me? that doesn't make any sense. Just because rent. I decide
you're renting your land from yeah. the city, basically.
And as I improve the land, it's not the city as the landlord improving it and increasing the rent. It's me improving the land, and then the city gets to increase the rent,
yeah.
which is the taxes.
Yeah.
And so Chase is pretty fired up about that. And I think he's got a very good point. I mean, you want to incentivize people to create and improve their land, but the city, the government in general, does the complete opposite. The more productive you are, the more successful you are, the higher tax bracket you're going to be in, the higher property tax zone you're going to mm-hmm. be in.
Yeah, it's odd because if you were to explain it to me, like, hey, you're going to buy this land, you're going to develop this land, and then forever you're going to pay these taxes on it, when it's not every year you're not refreshing and renewing the land, you know, it's a one-time deal. So I think we found out, so I purchased this land, where we're going to build the first Twisted Sugar location, from a good friend, Justin Hale, who has, you yeah. know, he's got plans for a fantastic gym there, but there was this strip of land that he didn't quite have any use for. It was a little extra. So I had this idea and proposed it to him, and he was on board because he's all for making Yuma better and let's bring fun things. And if you've got a fun thing to bring, yes, you know, let's do this deal. So I appreciate him being open to the idea of selling a sliver of that land to me. But we found out that as soon as we, just on paper, we didn't do anything to the land. It's still just vacant dirt. But all we did was we drew a line. We recorded a split from the property that I'm buying from him. That's all we did. That's all we did. Boom. Taxes went up 4 times.
Yeah.
We didn't do anything. We didn't improve it. We didn't add streets. We didn't add parking. We didn't add lighting. We didn't connect to sewer systems. We didn't connect to water. Nothing. We drew a line on a piece of paper, 4 times more money. So we went and fought that. Justin and I went and fought that
mm-hmm.
with the Board of Supervisors. They agreed that should wait until there's actual development on the land. So,
but you have to do that in every case?
Correct.
You didn't win it for the people of Yuma.
No. City at all. Our land. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so and I understand it's difficult for the assessors. How do you put value on things that don't sell for 50 years? How do you, you know, if you can only change the tax value as the property changes hands, you're real limited on how you can generate revenue for the city, how you can, in the meantime, streets might widen, schools might go in next door, which generate more traffic, more use of the land around you. But you haven't sold your land in 70 years. So there's a lot of places in town where the taxes have not increased or been reassessed for 40, 50 years. You know, yet these people are living there. The city's growing around them, but they're not contributing anymore towards the infrastructure of the city. My ideal situation is
yeah, and I would argue yes and no, they are and aren't.
Yeah.
Because if they are making that land productive, then there is going to be commercial transactions occurring, and that's what produces revenue, like a use tax. You know, anytime you sell a cookie, you pay
City sales tax. So
absolutely,
if I build something that brings in a lot of volume and brings a lot of tax dollars to the city, that should be the incentive to.
Yeah, the city should be encouraging that,
right.
And you're already contributing back to the city for the other infrastructure modifications that need to be made for that, but they're double dinging you by taxing you for the improvement that you made to the land and for the services that you're selling and the goods that you're producing.
Which I agree in the sense that we should be kicking in for our city. We should be supporting our city. We want our city to grow. We want our city to be beautiful.
Just which what's the most fair way to do it, though?
But what's the fair way to do that is really the argument. I would never argue that there should not be any property taxes. I think
really
there should be, but I agree with.
Well, then you don't own your property.
Well, what you guys landed on when you had my brother on was there should be a tax value assessed to that piece of land, And once that's paid off, no more. So a cap on that, I think, is fair. Or a sales tax on the transaction of the land. There's actually a tax on the purchase.
Okay.
And I would be in favor of one of those two options, a cap or a transaction tax. That's, you know, maybe some percentage or some fixed amount, on that, but this ongoing forever paying rent on property that I own free and clear. I own this dirt free and clear.
Yeah.
Where we're going to build this building.
No, you don't.
I still got to write a check.
Yeah. You don't own it, because stop paying the taxes and we'll see who owns it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, is there an alternative method for the city or county to raise the funds that they need? And that, and that's the other question. So there's two questions. Are there alternate ways to do it? Mm-hmm. And secondly, why do they need our money?
Well, you need our money to support community services, fire departments, road repair, street lights, all of those things that we enjoy, that makes our city, you know, beautiful, parks, all of those things. I agree we should have, we want. I think the best way to do it is to encourage business development, encourage sales revenue, transactions, me buying cheeseburgers from you, all of that generates. So if you have a healthy city that's developing, that's growing, you have that money coming in.
And we've
seen to be on the land
over and over and over again, that anytime you provide some type of incentive to buy something, for example, the EV incentive, you know, people go out and use that to buy more electronic vehicles or,
Electric
vehicles, electronics.
Also electronic. You hit it. You're
there. But, and anytime you tax something, then the transaction on that service or item goes down, just like the tariffs and all the scare there. But we seem to not get that at the government level. We say we need more money, so let's go to the industries that are benefiting society the most and hammer them because they've got money. But we want to incentivize these billionaires that are creating trillions of dollars throughout, you know,
employing thousands,
tens of thousands of people throughout the world,
right?
And providing a service where they drop off your package at your front door, and we all like that. So I am 100%. Every time you look at whether or not to do a tax, do we want that to diminish that activity, or do we want to increase it? If we want to diminish it, for example, smoking, okay, let's increase the tax on tobacco. Or drinking, okay, increase the tax on alcohol. If you want to increase that, so for example, creating new businesses and entrepreneurial opportunities, then let's give them a tax break. I think if you say, listen, I can take this bare piece of land that's been just like a blight on in the city for a long time, and I can create something that's going to be productive, that's going to generate sales tax, that's going to generate other types of revenue and a positive impact on the community. I think the city should say, okay, you propose your plan, now you're going to get some type of incentive for that. For example, Disneyland, right? They got this sweetheart deal where they were their own little government. They didn't pay taxes in Florida. And they did that because they brought so much revenue from tourism to Florida. Well, that's the right idea. Mm-hmm. I think it maybe went too far, but I think it's the right idea.
Right. I think all taxes should be capped. Everything. Once you've reached my level of contribution to the sales tax community, it should stop.
What about income?
Same.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think that I'm only going to be using so much of the services, the infrastructure that's provided for, that I think once I pay whatever it is, tax on $250,000 of income, that's how much I'm going to be using of the infrastructure. The rest of it, I'm actually helping other people make money and produce their own income tax. And so I shouldn't have to pay after that amount. Now, what that percentage is on the first $250,000, that's what gets determined. But I think that once I make that $250,000, then the sky should be the limit. I think I should be incentivized to grow exponentially more because that's going to increase everybody. That's good.
Yeah, but the philosophy is that if you get to keep more of your money, you'll just keep it.
But why?
So they need to take it from you, and you'll just sit on it and keep it.
Yes, that is the
philosophy. We know isn't the reality.
It is not the reality.
If I have more money at the end of the year, I'm going to say, okay, now I can finally bring on that extra employee that I've needed, or I'm going to be able to pay my employees more. They're going to be able to buy. They're going to move into newer cars. They're going to buy into bigger houses. Now they're paying those taxes. And
I'll create that satellite office.
That's how, I'm going to create another, I'm going to build another office. I'm going to stretch to another community. I'm going to do these things. But the mindset that these billionaires are sitting on billions of dollars is just completely false.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would they do
that? Most of that billions of dollars is in assets, real estate, research and development, growth. They're putting it back into their businesses. You know, yes, are they enjoying a lifestyle of a billionaire? Absolutely. You know, and more power to them. They created that. They didn't take that billions from other people. They generated it.
Right.
You know, they generated
it. And that is the false narrative.
That's the false narrative.
Somebody that has billions doesn't make that. They take it. And it's like, well, if it's capitalism, then everybody that contributed towards that billionaire's net worth did it voluntarily. The billionaire didn't walk around with a gun. And
if you have $1 billion business in town,
web services,
or $1 billion business owner in town, that it's likely that $1 billion business employs more than that person. And those people go to school and occupy the schools. Those people pay taxes into the system. Those people buy cars, drive cars to and from work. Everyone is benefiting off of this billionaire.
Yeah.
And so to criminalize making money is such, in my opinion, is such at such opposition from the spirit of America that it's hard for me to understand why anybody would begrudge somebody for making money. Now you could talk about how they made their money, what their business is. Is it a positive business, or is it, you know, making cigarettes?
But then you're legislating morality.
What's that?
Then you're legislating morality, which I think is impossible to do.
Yeah, you can't do that. And at the end of the day, these billionaires have landed on something that the people want. You know, they didn't just say, hey, I'm going to wake up tomorrow, I'm going to be a millionaire. No, they said, hey, here's a, you know, we talk about the things we hate. Here's something that I hate. I've got a solution to solve it. Guess what? Tens of millions of people enjoy it, love it, and are willing to give me money to produce, to provide this product or this service for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how many times do people start a business and the people don't want it? Well, they don't become millionaires. They fail.
Right.
You know, that's how it works. But you want to create, you know, billionaires, millionaires, thousandaires. You want to create that in your community, because that's what gives the community health and wealth, beautification, and all of those things. You can't have a community that's only middle class. You can't have that. It doesn't work, because everybody's just, I'm selling you a cheeseburger and then I'm buying a cheeseburger from you. It's a net zero.
Right.
You've got to have that mix of wealth, because that wealth then employs, then improves, then grows.
Well, and what's interesting is there isn't a class of billionaires that they started that way and then, you know, went throughout their life as a billionaire. Every billionaire that I know of didn't start out with $1 billion.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I don't have a whole lot of billionaires that I'm chummy friends with.
Yeah, are you hobnobbing with billionaires?
Yeah, no.
Behind my back?
Exactly.
But you were down here with us.
But I'm saying, we look at the story of all of these, you know, the Jeff Bezos, the Elon Musks, the Mark Zuckerbergers, the Bill Gates.
Cheeseburgers.
That's right.
That's
mine.
Yeah, the Bill Gates. And all of these individuals were not born billionaires, right?
Most of them were not. Yeah.
None of them were.
Yeah.
Right.
Or finished college.
Exactly. And so, but what they did is they went through and they went up the the chain and they risked it all and mm-hmm. they put together an idea that people really liked and signed on to and voluntarily gave their money to receive the services that they provided. And then they received their billions for it. And so this idea that billionaires are this class of people that should be demonized and therefore taxed heavy because they've taken the money from the proletariat, you know, the poor people in the communities is not only false, but an individual like me, for example, I went from living off of potatoes and ramen when I was 20 years old to now I can afford to go out and eat and to contribute to restaurants like this Sunflower District that you're going to put together, and I can buy a new car and I can do the nicer things because I've worked and in my lifetime went through several different tax brackets. Most people do that. Most people go through a variety of tax brackets. So there isn't this is the middle class, this is where they're born and this is where they're going to stay, or this is the, you know, poverty level individuals, this is where they're born, this is where they're going to stay. Maybe the most stagnant would be the poverty level individuals, but that might be because there's too much incentives to be in that.
Could be. I would argue.
Or too much of a gap between the incentive to get out of it.
Yeah.
And move to the next level.
I would argue that it is more difficult to ramp up out of poverty than to ramp up out of middle class.
It may be, but it
is tougher.
I would argue that that's not because of societal structure. It's because of a mentality or a...
There's a mentality there. There's, but what I would argue, I would say it's more difficult, but I would say there is the opportunity. There is the opportunity, and that's what America offers.
Yeah. There is
the opportunity that you can go from poverty to billionaire.
The mental block, what Adam is talking about, is the problem. And Hillbilly Eulogy by J.D. Vance, that describes perfectly the mental block that exists between being in poverty and pulling yourself out. Those who are in poverty think that a hard work ethic will help you become successful and is still part of the American dream and alive and well.
Right.
But those individuals, it was interesting because a lot of individuals were interviewed that were living on food stamps and in that, you know, poverty demographic, and they all felt that hard work would bring you up out of poverty. And then you look at them and they're sitting on their front porch all day. And so he describes it well, that it is possible they even understand it, but the incentive to stay below the poverty level on the books is too high because the government contributes to that lifestyle enough that why? You know, it's going to take a big change, a big shift in how many hours I work a day to get from the amount that I'm getting for free to more than what I'm getting for free because of my work.
Right.
And that's the problem, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an enabling that the government does. So the government comes in and they say, we want to fix this issue. All people should be wealthy. All people should be upper class, middle class. And so this is how we're going to do this. And then they put these regulations such that they're trying to equalize or make this person on the bottom be able to come. That's never going to work. You can't legislate that. And then really it's a mentality problem, what Sean's talking about. And I think that's what I see. So when you made the comment, well, yeah, I would argue that it's harder to come out from here than it is from, I don't know about that. I mean, I think reality is a person either has it mentally or they don't. They're either going to put forth effort or they're not. They might have issues throughout life that prevent them from stepping up every once in a while, but ultimately, I agree with you in the sense that we have a structure education-wise in the United States such that if I want to go out and make something of myself, I can do that, regardless of my color of my skin, my wealth, my poverty. It doesn't matter. I can do it. I can go to community college. I can get an associate's degree. I can transfer to university. I can get my doctorate. I can do whatever I want. There are ways to do it. Am I going to do it? That's the question.
Well, and are you willing to go through what it takes
Yeah.
to get it done?
Yeah.
That's the question. And the government can't the government cannot force that, and they never will.
No.
And so as a consequence, now we're stuck in the system where the government enables everything because they want everybody to win. They want everybody to be, you know, in middle class. They want everybody to stay alive during COVID. It's but not again, going to happen.
You can't have everyone be middle class because then who's employing
that's,
the middle class?
That's true.
Class?
You have to have the people
there is
that
a pecking
own
order,
the capital.
And there always will be.
You can't solve it by pulling people down. That's not, you have to lift people up. And the way you do that is there has to be people out of the hole with ropes and pulleys and systems to pull people up out of the hole.
Yeah.
So you can't have everybody jump down in the hole and then lift each other up like that. That doesn't work. You have to have these billionaires, these millionaires, these people that have these, granted, some of those resources they might have gotten just because of who they were and how they were born and where they lived. But are they using those resources to pull others up out of the hole? I would argue yes.
And
they are employing tens of thousands of people.
The other aspect,
paying good wages, providing products that you and I are willing to plunk down, you know, $400 a month for my phone bill. You know,
yeah.
I'm willing to plunk that mm-hmm. down. You know, those kinds of things. It all feeds for growth. It all, you know, if you've got a great idea, and that's really what's exciting about the Sunflower District. If somebody comes to us with a good food idea and they just don't have the money, well, let us help. You know, we believe in that idea. We want to foster that, grow it, incubate it. And then maybe those people will decide, hey, I've outgrown this. I'm super successful now. Now I've got the money to go and open a brick and mortar restaurant or mm-hmm. do these kinds of things. But it takes planning. It takes money. It takes time to give somebody an environment where that idea can now foster and grow. It doesn't just happen. And it's not going to happen by everyone being middle class, because then again, how do you know?
Yeah, it's not possible.
Yeah.
It never will be.
So one point that I want to make, and I know we're running out of time, but I want to make it anyway.
Go ahead.
Your show.
So
show.
Who?
Your show too, Adam.
Thank you.
You're saying somebody has to be higher up in order to give the opportunity, to give the loans to individuals that want to float an idea and put their blood, sweat, and equity, you know, their time and energy, their genius into this certain idea. And the government thinks that it is in the best position mm-hmm. to control those resources, where my argument would be, well, let's look at who actually created those resources. The government doesn't actually have any resources. If anybody's taking the billions, it's the government. The billionaires aren't taking it. They're being contributed to by a voluntary public. And so the people in the best position to control that capital are the people that worked hard to create that capital. So if at the bottom line, that is the really difference in ideologies. Who should be controlling capital? Should it be the government and controlling how it's distributed among the people, or should it be the individual that has demonstrated an ability to create capital and therefore produce it and has the ownership of that capital and has got their wealth on the line when they redistribute it in the course of trying to grow it additionally and spread it throughout society. So anytime that somebody argues the government needs to be controlling this because X, Y, and Z, they're more noble, they're more just. Well, how much did those government officials contribute to the money they want to control? Not much.
I think what you're talking about is skin in the game, right?
Skin in the game. I'm talking about socialism,
right?
Versus total capitalism. And socialism is we will take from the people that made and we will make a more just society by redistributing it, where I say capitalism is let the capitalist who made it redistribute it by determining what the best and most efficient way to do it is.
Well, the person who made it is going to be more inclined to protect it, grow it, use it, knows it better than anyone else. When you just take it, you didn't earn that. You don't have any skin in the game.
Not only that, but
so you're not going to care what you do with it.
But you
because
make,
you didn't go through what it takes to
make. And you haven't demonstrated the mental capacity to actually make something work. You may have a great idea, theoretically, but that if that idea really worked, then why weren't you a billionaire? You know, if that idea really was successful, why didn't you go out and sell it to the public and have them voluntarily give you money? No, you got their votes, and what you're really good at is selling ideas. Mm-hmm. But ideas don't produce anything. Actual labor, actual contributions with services, that's what does it. So when the government says, we are going to give this money, listen, government, give all the money that you personally owned or individual congressman
that you created,
right, that you created, which is none, and then you can redistribute that. But other than that, just let's provide the infrastructure that we vote on individually as towns and cities and state. And then why don't you protect the outside border of our country from invasion, and we'll do the rest.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to see somebody have more than you. And I think that's what gets preyed upon, that inclination that why should that person have more than me? And so rather than say, how can I get there? The mentality is we need to pull that person down. They shouldn't be up there, or you should take from them and give to me. And so unfortunately that is a natural human instinct, doesn't make it right to take. And so, that's the struggle that we have. So if you have politicians or government that plays on that instinct to take, and yes, we should take, and you know what, I'll take it for you, that's immoral, that's illegal, it shouldn't happen. It is difficult sometimes to see people that have more than you, that have a bigger house, a better car, a prettier family, you know, whatever it is, you know, that it's our human nature to to look at that and go, does that guy deserve that? You know, I do it all. I'm just as guilty. You know, I do it all the time. That guy deserved that. He's got that. What did he do to get that? And, you know, instead of saying what I should do is take that energy and say, you know what, how did he do that?
Yeah.
And can I do that? And you know what, he did it that way. Let me give it a shot and let me see if I can do that. So instead of taking, we should be fostering, here's how I did it and you can do it too. And let's do it together. We should have many, many, many more billionaires, you know, ideally, you know, that would be wonderful because those billionaires will employ tens of thousands of people. That's what grows the middle class. That's what brings people up out of poverty is opportunities, job opportunities. Hey, I'm opening this new factory. We've got several, you know, the new Amazon distribution center that's moving to town, the new battery manufacturing. That's going to employ everybody from engineers all the way down to, you know, delivery drivers. And it's going to employ those people, and it'll provide an avenue for those people to move up within that company or be exposed to an experience they didn't think they were good at and discover that they're good at it. And then, hey, you know, I know everything there is about truck. I'm going to start a trucking company. You know, I'm going to buy 4 trucks and I'm going to try, you know, that all happens once you get exposed to it and you have somebody, probably a billionaire at some level, fostering, providing you a place to put that to work. And so it's disheartening to see a mentality of, well, we should take it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no, you shouldn't take it. You know, that's not right. You didn't earn it, so you shouldn't have it. You know, so but you know, there's
charities
and everything else that you know, we can donate to,
yes,
and provide
and,
to.
And we've demonstrated again and again.
I don't think there should be no safety net, and I don't think you should leave people to just completely fend for themselves because some people don't have the skills or the education or the environment.
But who should provide the safety net, and how much is provided in that safety net? That is the big argument.
I think that's the age-old question.
It is the age-old question, and I think that the reason that socialism keeps creeping up in a society that has become so powerful and wealthy under this idea of capitalism or under this economic structure of capitalism is because it's enticing to talk to the population that doesn't have the have-nots, and to say, listen, I will be your savior. I will come in and make things right. These people over here, these minority capitalists that have everything, they have it because, and they'll make up whatever story, and it's always different, but whatever it is, it doesn't matter, because the people that don't have at the time of the life that they're in, that, you know, area of maybe poverty or lower class, then they say, yeah, okay, I like that idea. I like being able to get, and if I can assign some level of justice for getting something that I don't work for just because I vote for this politician, then absolutely. And that's why those ideas keep creeping around despite their 100% track record of failure. There has never been a demonstration of a successful communist or socialistic regime. There's never been a demonstration. And there's been many actual test runs with the same cultures. You look at North and South Korea, right? Same people, same culture, same work ethic. North Korea, not so great. South Korea, first world country, right? And you do that again and again and again, and you look at all of these different societies. It's not the individuals. It's not their work ethic. It's not their culture. It's the system of government that demonstrates what works and what doesn't. But we can't see that because politicians like to peddle the lies that if you don't have something and you want it quick and easy, which human nature is to do, then vote for me and I'll get you that quick and easy thing, and we'll hold the people that have it responsible.
Mm-hmm. We gotta go.
Happy 4th of July, guys.
Happy 4th of July.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about things I hate.
Oh, well, let's do it. We got a little time.
You got a little time?
Oh, no. We don't have to get into hate. You know, okay. Talking about 4th of July and the country. I love hot dogs. I hate a hot dog that's not all beef.
Yes.
I'll tell you that right now.
Absolutely.
100%. Put me on record.
Hebrew all National.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All beef.
Okay.
So eat all beef for this 4th of July.
Or you're not American.
You're not an American.
Thanks, Chris.
Yep. Thanks, guys.